Sir, Lawrence said, restraining his temper, you have not the proper supply for a heavyweight, and the daily distance you cross is a tenth of what he can do.
What difference does that make? General Lestocq said, bristling. I do not know what kind of discipline you run in England, but if you are with this army, you march with it. Good God, your dragon is hungry. So are all my men hungry. A fine form we should be in if I began letting them run 50 miles afield to feed themselves.
We would be at every evening's camp, Lawrence said.
Yes, you will be, Lestocq said. And you will be at the morning camp, and at the noon camp, and with the rest of the Dragon Corps at every moment, or I will have you down as a deserter. Now get out of my tent.
I take it things went well, Granby said,
looking at his face when Lawrence came back into the small, abandoned shepherd's hut which was their day's shelter, the first time they had slept dry in the week of slow and miserable marching since Posen. Lawrence threw his gloves down on the cot with violence and sat down to pull off his boots, ankle-deep in mud.
"I have half a mind to take Temeraire and be gone after all," Lawrence said furiously. "Let that old fool put us down as deserters if he likes. I'm a bit damned to him."
"Here,"
Granby said, and picked up some of the straw from the floor to take hold of the boot heel, so Lawrence could get his foot out.
"We could always go hunting and join up again if we see a fight coming," he said, wiping off his hands and sitting back down on his own cot. "They'll hardly turn us away."
Lawrence almost gave it consideration, but he shook his head.
"No. But if this continues as it is..."
It did not. Instead, their pace slowed even further, and the only thing in shorter supply than food was good news. Rumours had gone around the camp for several days that a peace settlement had been offered by the French. An almost general sigh of relief had issued from the weary troops, but as the days passed and no announcement came, hope failed. Then fresh rumours followed about the shocking terms. The whole vast swath of Prussian territory east of the Elbe to be surrendered, and Hanover too, huge indemnities to be paid, and, outrageously, the Crown Prince to be sent to Paris, under the care of the Emperor, to the improvement of understanding and friendship between our nations desirable to all, as the sinister phrasing had it.
"Good Lord! He does begin to think himself a proper Oriental despot, doesn't he?"
Granby said, hearing this news.
"What would he do if they broke the treaty, sent the boy to the guillotine?"
"He had Dongan murdered for less cause,"
Lawrence said, thinking with sorrow of the Queen, so charming and courageous, and how this fresh and personal threat should act upon her spirit. She and the King had gone on ahead to meet with the Tsar. That, at least, was a piece of encouragement. Alexander had pledged himself wholly to continue the war, and the Russian army was already on its way to rendezvous with them in Warsaw.
"Lawrence," Temeraire said,
and Lawrence shuddered up out of an old familiar night terror, finding himself utterly alone on the deck of the Belize, his first command, in a gale, all the ocean lit up by lightning flashes and not a human face anywhere in sight, with the unpleasant new addition of a dragon egg rolling ponderously towards the open forward hatch, too far for him to reach in time, not the green-speckled red of the Kazilik egg, but the pale porcelain of Temeraire's. He wiped the dream from his face and listened to the distant sounds, too regular for thunder.
"When did it begin?"
he asked, reaching for his boots. The sky was only just growing lighter.
"A few minutes ago," Temeraire said.
They were 3 days from Warsaw, on the 4th of November. All through that day's march they heard the guns to the east, and during the night a red glow of fire shone in the distance. The guns were fainter the next day, and silent by the afternoon. The wind had not changed. The army did not break from its midday camp. The men scarcely stirred, as if they all collectively held their breath, waiting. The couriers, sent off that morning, came back hurrying a few hours later, but though the captains went directly to the general's quarters, before they even came out again, the news was somehow already spreading. The French had beaten them to Warsaw. The Russians had been defeated.
Chapter 16. The small castle had been built of red brick, a long time ago. Wars had battered it. Peasants looking for building materials had dismantled it. Rain and snow had melted down its edges. It was little more than a gutted shell now, one wall held up between half-crumbled towers, windows that faced onto open fields on both sides. They were grateful for the shelter nonetheless, Temeraire huddling for concealment into the square made by the ruined walls,
the rest of them sheltering in the single, narrow gallery, full of red brick dust and crumbled white mortar.
"We will stay another day," Lawrence said in the morning, more an observation than a decision.
Temeraire was grey and limp with exhaustion, and the rest of them hardly in better state. He asked for volunteers to go hunting and sent Martin and Dunn. The countryside was alive with French patrols, and Polish also, formed of dragons released from the Prussian breeding grounds, where they had been pent up since the final partition 10 years before. During the intervening years, many of their captains had died in Prussian captivity, or from age or sickness. The bereft dragons were full of bitterness, which had easily enough been turned to Napoleon's use. They might not answer to discipline well enough to serve in battle without captain or crew, but they could profitably be set to scouting, and no harm done if they should take it on themselves to attack some hapless group of Prussian stragglers. And the army was nothing but stragglers now, all of them making only loosely for the last Prussian strongholds in the north. There was no more hope of victory. The generals had spoken only of securing some position that might strengthen their hands at the bargaining table a little. It seemed to Lawrence folly. He doubted himself whether there would be any table at all. Napoleon had sent his armies speeding across the sodden roads of Poland with not a single wagon to hold them back, dragons carrying all the supply, gambling that he could catch and beat the Russians before his food ran out and his men and beasts began to starve. He had risked all on one throw of the dice, and won. The Tsar's armies had been strung out along the road to Warsaw, wholly unsuspecting, and in 3 days and three battles he had smashed them in their separate parts. The Prussian army he had carefully skirted on the road. They had served him, they understood only too late, as bait to draw the Russians more quickly from their borders. Now the jaws of the Grande Armée were closing in on them for the final bite. The army had spilled northward in desperation, whole battalions deserting at a time. Lawrence had seen artillery and ammunition abandoned on the road, supply wagons surrounded by clouds of birds feasting on grain spilled in struggles among the starving men. Lestock had sent orders to the covert to send the Dragon Corps to their next post, a small village 10 miles away. Lawrence had crumpled the dispatch in his hand and let it fall to the ground to be trampled into the mud, and then he had put his men aboard with all the supplies they could find, and flown north as long as Temeraire's strength would allow. What so complete a defeat should mean for Britain he would not now consider. He had one goal only, to get Temeraire and his men home, and the 2 dragon eggs. They seemed now pitifully inadequate, when they should have to help be a wall around Britain, to defend her against an emperor of Europe in search of more worlds to conquer. If he had been once again on that hill, in the brush, with Napoleon standing so close to hand, Lawrence did not know what he would do. He wondered occasionally, in the sleepless hours of the night, if Badenhauer blamed him for staying his hand. He did not feel any kind of black mood or anger, such as had occasionally fallen upon him after a defeat, only a great distance. He spoke calmly to his men and to Temeraire. He had managed to get his hands on a map, at least, of their route to the Baltic Sea, and spent most of his hours studying how to skirt the towns, or how to get back on course after a patrol had forced them to flee out of their way to a temporary safety. Though Temeraire could cover ground far more quickly than infantry, he was by far more visible as well, and their progress northward did not much outstrip the rest of the army after all their dodging and evasions. There was little left in the countryside to forage, and they were all going hungry, giving whatever could be spared to Temeraire. Now, in the ruins of the castle, the men slept, or lay listless and open-eyed against the walls, not moving. Martin and Dunn came back after nearly an hour with one small sheep shot neatly through the head.
"I'm sorry for having to use the rifle, sir, but I was afraid it would get away," Dunn said. "We didn't catch sight of anyone," Martin added anxiously. "It was off alone. I expect it had wandered away from its herd."
"You did as you ought, gentlemen," Lawrence said, without attending very much. If they had done anything badly, it would still hardly have been worth reproaching them.
"I take it first,"
Gongsu said urgently, catching his arm, when Lawrence would have given it straight to Temeraire.
"Let me, it will go further. I make soup for everyone. There is water." "We haven't much biscuit left,"
Granby ventured to him, very quiet and tentatively at this suggestion.
"It would put heart into the fellows to have a taste of some meat."
"We cannot risk an open flame," Lawrence said with finality.
"'No, not open fire,' Gong Su pointed to the tower. "'I build inside. Smoke comes out slow from this.' And he tapped the crevices between the bricks in the wall beside them. "'Like smokehouse.'
The men had to come out of the closed gallery, and Gong Su could only go in to stir for a few minutes at a time, coming out coughing and with his face covered with black, but the smoke seeped out only in thin, flat bands which clung to the brick and did not send up any great column. Lawrence turned back to his maps, laid out on top of a broken, table-sized block of wall. He thought a few more days would see them to the coastline, and then he would have to decide, west for Danzig, where the French might be, or east to Königsberg, almost surely still in Prussian hands, but farther from home. He was all the more grateful now to his meeting with the embassy secretary in Berlin, who had given him the now priceless information that the navy was out in the Baltic in force. Temeraire had only to reach the ships, and they would be safe. Pursuit could not follow them into the teeth of the ships' guns. He was working out the distances for the third time when he lifted his head, frowning. Men were stirring a little across the camp. The wind was shifting into their faces and carrying a snatch of song. Not very tuneful, but sung with great enthusiasm in a girl's clear voice, and in a moment she came into view around the wall. She was just a peasant girl, bright-cheeked with exercise, with her hair neatly braided back beneath a kerchief, and carrying a basket full of walnuts and red berries and branches laden with yellow and amber leaves. She turned the corner and saw them. The song stopped mid-phrase, and she stared at them with wide, startled eyes, still open-mouthed. Lawrence straightened up. His pistols were lying in front of him, waiting down the corners of his maps. Dunn and Hackley and Riggs all had their rifles right in their hands, being that moment engaged in reloading. Pratt, the big armourer, was leaning against the wall in arm's reach of the girl. A word, and she would be caught. Silenced. He put his hand out and touched the pistol. The cold metal was like a shock to his skin, and abruptly he wondered what the devil he was doing. A shudder seized him, shoulders to waist and back, and suddenly he was himself again, fully present in his own skin, and astonished by the change of sensation. He was at once painfully, desperately hungry, and the girl was running away wildly down the hill, her basket flung away in a hail of golden leaves. He continued the movement and put the pistols back into his belt, letting the maps roll up.
"'Well, she will have everyone in 10 miles roused in a moment,' he said briskly. "'Gong Su, bring the stew out. We can have a swallow at least before we must get about it, and Temeraire can eat while we pack. And Roland, Dyer, do you two go and collect those walnuts and crack the shells?'
The two runners hopped over the wall and began to gather up the spilled contents of the peasant girl's basket, while Pratt and his mate Blythe went in to help carry out the big soup pot. Lawrence said,
"'Mr. Granby, let us see a little activity here, if you please. I want a lookout up on that tower.'
"'Yes, sir,'
Granby said, jumping at once to his feet, and with Ferris began rousing the men from their own separate lethargies to begin pushing the broken stone and brick into something like steps up the side of the tower. The work did not go quickly, with the men all tired and shaky, but it gave them more life, and the tower was not so very high. Soon enough they had a rope thrown over one of the crenellations of the parapet, and Martin was scrambling up to keep watch, calling, "'And don't you fellas eat my share, either!' to more laughter than this feeble sally deserved. The men turned eagerly to get out their tin cups and bowls, as the cauldron came very carefully out, not a drop spilling.
"'I am sorry we must go so quickly,' Lawrence said to Temeraire, stroking his nose.
"'I do not mind,'
Temeraire said, nuzzling him with particular energy.
"'Lawrence, you are well?'
Lawrence was ashamed that his queer mood should have been so noticeable.
"'I am. Forgive me for having been so out of sorts,' he answered. "'You have had the worst of it all along. I ought never have committed us to this enterprise.'
"'But we did not know that we were going to lose,' Temeraire said. "'I am not sorry to have tried to help. I would have felt a great coward running away.'
Gong Su ladled out the still thin soup in small, sparing portions, half a cupful to each man, and Ferris doled out the biscuit. At least there was as much tea as anyone could want to drink, situated as the castle was between two lakes. They all ate involuntarily slowly, trying to make each bite count for two, and then Roland and Dyer went around with the odd, unexpected treat of fresh walnuts, a little young and bitter, but delicious. The purplish sloes, too tart for their palates, Temeraire licked up out of the basket as a single swallow. When all had eaten their share, Lawrence sent Salya up in Martin's place, and had the midshipman down for his own meal.
and then Gong Su began heaving the dismembered joints of the sheep's carcass out of the cauldron one at a time, directly into Temeraire's waiting jaws, so the hot juice would not run out of them and go to waste. Temeraire, too, lingered over each swallow, and he had scarcely consumed the head and one leg before Salia was leaning over and shouting and scrambling down the rope.
"Air patrol, sir! 5 middleweights coming!"
he panted. A worse threat than Lawrence had feared. The patrol must have been sheltering just at the nearby village, and the girl must have run straight to them.
5 miles distant, I should think!"
The meal behind them and the immediate danger before gave them all a burst of fresh energy. In moments the equipment was back aboard, the light mesh armour laid out. They had left behind the armour plates several escapes ago. Then Keynes said,
"For the love of heaven, don't eat the rest of the meat!"
sharply to Temeraire, who was just opening his mouth for Gong Su to tip in the last mouthfuls.
"Why not?" Temeraire demanded. "I am still hungry."
"The blasted egg is hatching!"
Keynes said. He was already tearing and heaving at the silken swaddling, throwing off great shining panels of green and red and amber.
"Don't stand there gawking! Come and help me!"
he snapped. Granby and the other lieutenants sprang to his assistance at once, while Lawrence hurriedly organized the men to get the second egg, still wrapped up, back into Temeraire's belly rigging. It was the last of the baggage.
"Not now," Temeraire said to the egg,
which was now rocking back and forth so energetically that they were having to hold it in place with their hands. It would otherwise have gone rolling end over end across the ground.
"Go and get the harness arranged,"
Lawrence told Granby, and took his place bracing the egg. The shell was hard and glossy and queerly hot to the touch under his hands, so he even took a moment to pull on his gloves. Ferris and Riggs on the other side were wincing their hands away alternately.
"We must leave at this moment. You cannot hatch now. And anyway there is almost no food,"
Temeraire added, to no apparent effect but a furious rapping noise from inside against the shell.
"It is not paying me any mind," he said, aggrieved,
sitting back on his haunches, and looked rather unhappily at the remnants in the cauldron. Fellows had long since put together a dragonette's rig out of the softest scraps of harness, just in case, but it had been rolled up snugly with the rest of the leather deep in their baggage. They finally got it out, and Granby turned it over with almost shaking hands, opening some buckles and adjusting others.
"Nothing to it, sir," Fellows said softly.
The other officers clapped him on the back with encouraging murmurs.
"Lawrence," Keynes said in an undertone, "I ought to have thought of this before, but you had better draw Temeraire away at once, as far as you can. He won't like it."
"What?" Lawrence said, just as Temeraire said, with a flare of belligerence.
"What are you doing? Why is Granby holding that harness?"
Lawrence thought at first, in deep alarm, that Temeraire was speaking out against the harnessing of the dragon in principle.
"No, but Granby is in my crew,"
Temeraire said obstinately, an objection which disqualified every man in sight, unless perhaps he had not yet formed an attachment to Badenauer or the handful of other Prussian officers.
"I do not see why I must give it my food and Granby."
The shell was beginning to crack now, none too soon. The patrol had slowed their approach out of caution, perhaps imagining that the British meant to make a stand from behind the shelter of the walls, since evidently they were not fleeing. But caution would only keep them off so long. Soon one of them would make a quick dart overhead, see what was going on, and then they would instantly attack in force.
"Temeraire,"
Lawrence said, backing away a distance and trying to distract Temeraire's attention from the hatching egg.
"Only consider, the little dragon will be quite alone, and you have a large crew all for yourself. You must see it is not fair. There is no one else for the dragonette, and,"
he added with sudden inspiration,
"it will have no jewels at all, such as you have. It must surely feel very unhappy."
"Oh," Temeraire said.
He put his head down very close to Lawrence.
"Perhaps it could have Alan,"
he suggested quietly, with a darting look over his shoulder to make sure he was not overheard by that awkward young ensign, who was presently engaged in surreptitiously running his finger around the rim of the pot and licking it clean of a few more drops of soup.
"Come, that is unworthy of you," Lawrence said reprovingly. "Besides, this is Granby's chance of promotion. Surely you would not deny him the right to advance himself?"
Temeraire made a low grumbling noise.
"Well, if he must,"
he said ungraciously, and curled up to sulk, taking up his sapphire breastplate in his foreclaws to nose over and rub to a higher shine with the side of his cheek. His agreement was only just in time. The shell did not so much break open as burst with a cloud of steam, speckling them all with tiny fragments of shell and egg slime.
I did not make such a mess,
Temeraire said disapprovingly, brushing at the bits stuck to his hide. The dragonet itself spat bits of shell in every direction. It was hissing below its breath in a strangled sort of way. It was almost a miniature in form of the adult Kazalix, with the same bristling, thorny spines all over, scarlet with shining purplish armour plates over its belly. Even the impressive horns were there, smaller in scale. Only the green leopard spots were missing. The baby dragon looked up at them with glaring yellow eyes, hot and indignant, coughed once, twice, and then drew in and held a deep breath that made its sides puff out like a balloon. Abruptly, thin jets of steam issued out of its spines, hissing, and it opened its mouth and jetted out a little stream of flame some 5 feet long, sending the nearest men jumping back in surprise.
"Oh, there," she said, pleased, sitting up on her haunches. "That is much better. Now let me have the meat."
And Granby had been looking perfectly white beneath his sunburn, but he managed a steady voice as he stepped nearer her. He was holding the harness draped across his right arm, where she could see it plainly, without thrusting it at her.
"My name is John Granby," he said. "We will be happy to—"
"Yes, yes, the harnessing," she interrupted. "Temeraire has told me about that."
Lawrence turned and eyed Temeraire, who looked vaguely guilty and pretended to be very occupied polishing away a scratch on his breastplate. Lawrence began to wonder what else he might have instructed the eggs in, as he had been nursemaiding them now nearly 2 months. Meanwhile the dragonette put her head out to sniff at Granby. She tilted her head first to one side and then the other, looking him up and down.
"And you have been Temeraire's first officer?" she said interrogatively, with the air of one asking for references.
"I have," Granby said, rather flustered. "And should you like a name of your own? It is a very nice thing to have. I would be happy to give you one."
"Oh, I have already decided that,"
she said, much to Granby's further consternation, and that of the other aviators.
"I want to be Iskierka, like that girl was singing about."
Lawrence had harnessed Temeraire more by accident than design, and since then had never seen another hatching. He did not have any very clear idea of how it was supposed to go, but judging by the expressions of his men, this was not characteristic. However, the baby Kazalik added,
"But I should like to have you as my captain anyway, and I do not mind being harnessed and fighting to help protect England. But hurry, because I am very hungry."
Poor Granby, who had likely been dreaming of this day since he had been a 7-year-old cadet, every moment planned out with full ceremony and the name long since chosen, looked tolerably blank for a moment. Then abruptly he laughed out loud.
"All right, Iskierka it is," he said,
recovering handsomely, and held out the neck loop of the harness.
"Will you put your head in here?"
She cooperated quite willingly, except for stretching her head impatiently out towards the pot while he hurried to fasten the last few buckles, and when finally loosed she thrust her entire head and forelegs into the still-hot cauldron to devour the remains of Temeraire's dinner. She did not need any encouragement to eat quickly. The contents vanished with blazing speed, the pot rocking back and forth as she finished licking it clean.
"That was very good,"
she said, lifting her head out again, her little horns dripping with soup.
"But I would like some more. Let us go hunting."
She experimentally fluttered out her wings, still soft and crumpled against her back.
"Well, we can't now. We must get out of here," Granby said, keeping a prudent hold of her harness.
And a sudden storm of wings came above as one of the patrol dragons finally came and put its head over the wall to see what they were doing. Temeraire sat up and roared, and it back-winged hastily away, but the damage was done. It was already calling to its fellows.
"All aboard, no ceremony!" Lawrence shouted,
and the crew hastily flung themselves onto the harness.
"Temeraire, you must carry Iskierka. Will you put her aboard?"
"I can fly myself," she said. "Is there going to be a battle? Now? Where is it?"
She did indeed lift off into the air a little ways, but Granby managed to keep his grip on her harness, and she ended by bouncing back and forth.
"No, we are not going to have a battle," Temeraire said, "and anyway you are too little to fight just yet."
He bent down his head and closed his jaws around her body. The gap between his sharp front teeth and those to the rear held her neatly, and though she squalled in angry protest, he picked her up and laid her down across his shoulders. Lawrence gave Granby a leg up to the harness so he could scramble to her straight away, and followed himself. All the crew were aboard, and Temeraire launched himself with a leap, even as the patrol came charging over the wall. Roaring, he threw himself straight up into their midst and knocked them all away like ninepins.
"Oh, oh, they are attacking us! Quick, let us kill them!"
Iskierka said, with appalling bloodthirstiness, trying to leap off into the air.
"No, for heaven's sake, stop that!"
Granby said, clinging to her desperately, while with his other hand he struggled to get carabiner straps on her to latch her harness securely to Temeraire's.
"We're going a dashed sight faster right now than you could manage. Be patient! We'll go flying as much as you like, only give it a little while."
"But there is a battle now,"
she said, squirming around to try and see the enemy dragons. She was hard to get a proper hold of, with all her spiky, thorn-like protrusions, and she was scrabbling at Temeraire's neck and harness with her claws, still soft, but evidently ticklish from the way Temeraire snorted and tossed his head.
"Hold still,"
Temeraire said, looking around. He had taken advantage of the temporary disarray of the enemy dragons to put on a burst of speed, and was flying fast for a thick cloud bank to the north, which might conceal them.
"You are making it very difficult for me to fly."
"I don't want to be still,"
she said shrilly.
"Go back, go back! The fighting is that way!"
For emphasis, she fired off another jet of flame, which only narrowly escaped singeing off Lawrence's hair, and danced with impatience from one foot to the other, with all Granby could do to hold her. The patrol came on rapidly after them, and they did not give up after the cloud cover hid Temeraire from their sight, but kept on, calling out to one another in the mist to make sure of their positions, and advancing more slowly. The cold damp was unpleasant to the little Kazalik, who coiled herself around Granby's chest and shoulders in loops for warmth, narrowly avoiding strangling him or jabbing him with spikes, and kept up a muttering complaint about their running away.
"Do hush, there's a dear creature," Granby said, stroking her. "You'll give away our place. It is like hide-and-seek. We must be quiet."
"We would not need to be quiet or stay in this nasty cold cloud if only we went and thrashed them," she said,
but finally subsided. At length the sound of the searchers died away, and they dared to slip out again, but now a fresh difficulty presented itself. Iskierka had to be fed.
"We will have to risk it," Lawrence said,
and they flew cautiously away from the thick woods and lakes, and closer to farmland territory, while they searched the ground with spyglasses.
"How nice those cows would be," Temeraire said wistfully after a little while.
Lawrence hurriedly turned his glass to the far distance and saw them, a herd of fine cattle grazing placidly upon a slope.
"Thank heaven," Lawrence said. "Temeraire, go to ground, if you please. That hollow there will do, I think," he added, pointing. "We will wait until after dark and take them then."
"What? The cows?" Temeraire said, looking around with some confusion as he descended. "But, Lawrence, are those not property?"
"Well, yes, I suppose they are," Lawrence said in embarrassment. "But under the circumstances, we must make an exception."
"But how are the circumstances any different than when Arkady and the others took the cows in Istanbul?" Temeraire demanded. "They were hungry then, and we are hungry now. It is just the same."
"There we were arriving as guests," Lawrence said, "and we thought the Turks our allies."
"So it is not theft, if you do not like the person who owns the property?" Temeraire said. "But then—"
"No, no,"
Lawrence said hastily, foreseeing many future difficulties.
"But at present, the exigencies of war—"
He fumbled through some explanation, trailing off lamely. Of course, it would seem rather like theft, although this was, at least on the maps, Prussian territory, so it might reasonably be called requisition. But the distinction between requisition and theft seemed difficult to explain, and Lawrence did not at all mean to tell Temeraire that so had all their food the past week been stolen, and likely near enough all the supply from the army, too. In any case, call it bald-faced theft or some more pleasant word, it was still necessary. The little dragon was too young to understand having to go hungry, and was in more desperate need. Lawrence well remembered the way Temeraire had gone through food in his early weeks of rapid growth, and they were in great need, too, of her silence. If thoroughly fed, she would probably sleep away all the time between meals for her first week of life.
"Lord, she's a proper terror, isn't she?"
Granby said lovingly, stroking her glossy hide. Despite her impatient hunger, she had fallen into a nap while they waited for the night to come.
"Breathing fire straight from the shell! It will be a fright to manage her."
He did not sound as though he objected.
"Well, I hope she will soon become more sensible," Temeraire said.
He had not quite recovered from his earlier disgruntlement, and his temper had not been improved by her accusations of cowardice and demands to go back and fight. Certainly his own instinctive inclination, if an impractical one. More generally, it seemed his devotion to the eggs had curiously not translated to immediate affection for the dragonette, though perhaps he was merely still annoyed at being robbed to feed her.
"She is precious young," Lawrence said, stroking Temeraire's nose.
"I am sure I was never so silly, even when I was first hatched," Temeraire said, to which remark Lawrence prudently made no answer.
An hour after sunset, they crept up the slope from downwind and made their stealthy attack. Or so it might have been, save in a frenzy of excitement, Ischiaca clawed through the carabiner straps holding her on, and flung herself over the fence and onto the back of one of the sleeping, unsuspecting cows. It bellowed in terror and bolted away with all the rest of the herd, with a dragonette clinging aboard and shooting off flames in every direction but the right one, so the affair took on the character more of a circus than a robbery. The house lit up, and the farmhands dashed out with torches and old muskets, expecting perhaps foxes or wolves. They halted at the fence, staring, as well they might. The cow had taken to frantic bucking, but Ischiaca had her claws deeply embedded in the roll of fat around its neck, and was squealing half in excitement, half in frustration, ineffectually biting at it with her still small jaws.
"Only now look what she has done,"
Temeraire said self-righteously, and jumped aloft to snatch the dragonette and her cow in one claw, a second cow in the other.
"I am sorry we have woken you up. We are taking your cows. But it is not stealing, because we are at war," he said, hovering, to the white and frozen little group of men now staring up at his vast and terrible form, whose incomprehension came even more from terror than from language.
Feeling pangs of guilt, Lawrence hastily fumbled at his purse and threw some gold coins down.
"Temeraire, do you have her? For heaven's sake, let us be gone at once. They will have the whole country after us."
Temeraire did have her, as was proven once in the air by her muffled but audible yelling from below.
"It is my cow! It is mine! I had it first!"
Which did not greatly improve their chances of hiding. Lawrence looked back and saw the whole village shining like a great beacon out of the dark, one house after another illuminating. It would certainly be seen for miles.
"We had better have taken them in broad daylight, blowing a fanfare on trumpets," Lawrence said with a groan, feeling that it was a judgment on him for stealing.
They put down only a little way off out of desperation, hoping to feed Ischiaca and make her quiet. At first she refused to let go of her cow, now quite dead, having been pierced through by Temeraire's claws, though she could not quite get through its hide and begin eating.
"It is mine,"
she kept muttering, until at last Temeraire said,
"Be quiet. I only want to cut it open for you. Now let go. Anyway, if I wanted your cow, I would take it away."
"I should like to see you try,"
she said, and he whipped his head down and growled at her, which made her squeak and jump straight for Granby, who was knocked sprawling by her landing unexpectedly in his arms.
"Oh, that was not nice,"
she said indignantly, coiling around Granby's shoulders.
"Only because I am still small."
Temeraire had the grace to look a little ashamed of himself, and he said a little more placatingly,
"Well, I'm not going to take your cow anyway. I have one of my own. But you should be polite while you are still so little."
"I want to be big now," she said sulkily.
"You shan't get bigger unless you let us feed you properly," Granby said, which drew her quick attention. "Come, and you shall watch us make it ready for you. How will that do?"
"I suppose,"
she said, reluctantly, and he carried her back over to the carcass. Gongsu slit open the belly and cut out first the heart and the liver, which he held out to her with a ceremonial air, saying, "Best first meal for little dragons to get big." And she said,
"Oh, is it?"
and snatched them in both claws to eat with great gusto, blood pouring out the sides of her jaws as she tore and swallowed one bite and another from each one in turn. One of the leg joints was all the rest which she could manage, despite her best efforts, and then she collapsed into a stupor to their general and profound gratitude. Temeraire devoured the rest of his own cow, while Gongsu crudely and quickly butchered the remnants of the second and packed it away in his pots, and they were back aloft in some 20 minutes, with the dragonette now lying heavy and asleep in Granby's arms, quite dead to all the world. But there were dragons circling over the illuminated village in the distance now, and as they rose up one of them turned to look at them, its luminous white eyes shining. A fleur de nuit, one of the few nocturnal breeds.
North, Lawrence said grimly. Straight north as quick as you can, Temeraire. To the sea.
They fled all the rest of the night, the queer, low voice of the fleur de nuit sounding always behind them like a deep brass note, and the answering higher voices of the middleweights following its lead. Temeraire was burdened more heavily than their pursuers, carrying all his ground crew and supplies, and Ischiaca to boot. It seemed to Lawrence she had already visibly grown. Still Temeraire managed to keep ahead, but only just, and there was no hope of losing them. The night was cold and clear, the moon barely short of full. The miles spilled away, the Vistula River beneath them unwinding towards the sea, black and glistening occasionally with ripples. They loaded all their guns fresh, readied the flash-powder charge, and Fellows and his harness men struggled all the way up Temeraire's side, notch by notch, with a square of spare chain-mesh to lay over Ischiaca for protection. She murmured, without waking, and snuggled closer to Granby as they draped it over her body, hooking it to the rings of her little harness. Lawrence thought at first that the enemy had started shooting at them from too far away. Then the guns sounded again, and he recognized the sound. Not rifles, but artillery in the distance. Temeraire turned towards it at once, to the west. Out before them was opening the vast, unbroken blackness of the Baltic, and the guns were Prussian guns, defending the walls of Danzig.
Chapter 17.
"I am sorry you should have shut yourself into this box with us," General Kalkreuth said, passing to him the bottle of truly excellent port, which Lawrence could appreciate sufficiently to tell it was being wasted on his palate after the past month of drinking weak tea and watered rum. It followed on several hours full of sleep and dinner, and the still better comfort of seeing Temeraire eat as much as he wished. There was no rationing, at least not yet. The city's warehouses were full, the walls fortified, and the garrison strong and well-trained. They would not easily be starved out or demoralized into surrender. The siege might last a long time. Indeed, the French seemed in no hurry to begin it properly.
"You see, we are a convenient mousetrap," Kalkreuth said, and took Lawrence to the southern-facing windows.
In the waning daylight, Lawrence could see the French encampments arranged in a loose circle around the city, out of artillery fire range, astride the river and the roads.
"Daily I see our men coming in from the south, the remnants of Lestocq's division, and falling into their hands as neatly as you please. They must have taken 5,000 prisoners already at least. From the men they only take their muskets and their parole and send them home, so as not to have the feeding of them. The officers they keep."
"How many men do they have?" Lawrence asked, trying to count tents.
"You are thinking of a sortie, and so have I been," Kalkreuth said. "But they are too far away. They would be able to cut the force off from the city. When they decide to start besieging us in earnest and come a little closer, we may have some action. For what good it will do us, now that the Russians have made peace."
"Oh, yes," he added, seeing Lawrence's surprise.
"The Tsar decided he would not throw a good army after bad in the end, and perhaps that he did not want to spend the rest of his life as a French prisoner. There is an armistice, and they are negotiating a treaty in Warsaw, the two emperors, as the best of friends."
He gave a bark of laughter.
"So you see, they may not bother getting us out. By the end of this month I may be a citoyen myself."
He had only just escaped the final destruction of Prince Hohenlohe's corps, having been ordered to Danzig by courier to secure the fortress against just such a siege.
"They first appeared on my doorstep less than a week later, without warning," he said. "But since then I have had all the news I could want. That damned marshal keeps sending me copies of his own dispatches, of all the impudence, and I cannot even throw them in his face because my own couriers cannot get through."
Temeraire himself had barely made it over the walls. Most of the French dragons enforcing the blockade were presently on the opposite side of the city, barring it from the sea, and surprise had saved them from the artillery below. However, they were now properly in the soup. Several more pepper guns had made their appearance amid the French guns since that morning, and long-range mortars were being dug into place all around. The walled citadel itself was some 5 miles distant from the ocean harbour.
From Calcroit's windows, Lawrence could see the last shining curve of the Vistula River, its mouth broadening as it spilled into the sea, and the cold, dark blue of the Baltic was dotted over with the white sails of the British Navy. Lawrence could even count them through the glass. 2 64s, a 74 with a broad pennant, a couple of smaller frigates as escort, all of them standing only a little way off the shore. In the harbour itself, protected by the guns of the warships, lay the big, lumbering transport hulks which had been waiting to go and fetch Russian reinforcements to the city. Reinforcements that now would never come. 5 miles distant, and as good as 1,000, with the French artillery and aerial corps standing in between.
"And now they must know that we are here and cannot reach them,"
Lawrence said, lowering the glass.
"They could hardly have avoided seeing us come in yesterday with a fuss the French made."
"It's that Fleur de Nuit who chased us here that is the worst trouble," Granby said. "Otherwise, I should say, let us just wait until the dark of the moon and make a dash for it. But you may be sure that fellow will be waiting for us to try just such a thing. He'd have all the rest of them on us before we could clear the walls."
Indeed, that night they could see the big, dark, blue dragon as a shadow against the moonlit ocean, sitting up alertly on his haunches in the French covert, his enormous pallid eyes almost unblinking and fixed on the city walls.
"You are a good host,"
Marshal Lefebvre said cheerfully, accepting without demur another tender pigeon upon his plate, and attacking it and the heap of boiled potatoes with gusto, and manners perhaps more suited to a guard sergeant than a marshal of France, not surprising as he had begun his military career as such, and life as the son of a miller.
"We've been eating boiled grass and crows with our biscuit these 2 weeks."
He wore his curly hair grey and unpowdered over a round peasant's face. He had sent emissaries to try and open negotiations, and had accepted sincerely and without hesitation Calcroit's caustic reply. An invitation to dine in the city itself to discuss the matter of surrender. He had ridden up to the gates with no more escort than a handful of cavalrymen.
"I'd take more risk for a dinner like this,"
he said with a rolling laugh, when one of the Prussian officers commented ungraciously on his courage.
"It's not as though you'd get anything for long by putting me in a dungeon, after all, except to make my poor wife cry. The Emperor has a lot of swords in his basket."
After he had demolished every dish and mopped up the last of the juices from his plate with bread, he promptly let himself doze off in his chair while the port went around, and woke up only as the coffee was set before them.
"Ah, that gives life to a man,"
he said, drinking 3 cups in quick succession.
"Now then,"
he went on briskly, without a pause,
"you seem like a sensible fellow and a good soldier. Are you going to insist on dragging this all out?"
The mortified Calcroit, who had not meant in the least to suggest he would truly entertain a suggestion of surrender, said coolly,
"I hope I will maintain my post with honour until I receive orders to the contrary from His Majesty." "Well, you won't," Lefebvre said prosaically, "because he's shut up in Königsberg, just like you are here. I'm sure it's no shame to you. I won't pretend I'm a Napoleon, but I hope I can take a city with 2-to-1 odds and all the siege guns I need. I'd just as soon save the men, yours and mine both."
"I am not Colonel Ingersleben," Calcroit said, referring to the gentleman who had so quickly handed over the fortress of Stettin.
"To surrender my garrison without a shot fired? You may find us a tougher nut to digest than you imagine." "We'll let you out with full honours," Lefebvre said, refusing to rise to the bait. "And you and your officers can go free, so long as you give parole not to fight against France for 12 months. Your men, too, of course, though we'll take their muskets. That's the best I can do, but still it'll be a damn sight nicer than getting shot or taken prisoner." "I thank you for your kind offer," Calcroit said, getting up. "My answer is no."
"Too bad,"
Lefebvre said without dismay, and got up also, putting on the sword he had casually slung over the back of his chair.
"I don't say it'll stay open forever, but I hope you'll keep it in mind as we go on."
He paused on turning, seeing Lawrence, who had been seated some distance down the table, and added,
"Though I'd better say now it doesn't apply to any British soldiers you have here."
"Sorry," he said to Lawrence apologetically.
"The Emperor has a fixed notion over you English, and anyway we've orders about you in particular. If you're the one with that big China dragon who came sailing over our heads the other day. Ha!
You caught us sitting on the pot, and no mistake."
With this final laugh at his own expense, he tramped out, whistling, to collect his escort and ride back out of the walls, leaving all of them thoroughly depressed by his good cheer, and Lawrence to spend the night imagining all the most lurid sorts of orders which Lien might have persuaded Bonaparte to make concerning Temeraire's fate.
"I hope I need not tell you, Captain, that I have no thoughts of accepting this offer,"
Calcrite said to him the next morning, having summoned him to breakfast to receive this reassurance.
"Sir," Lawrence said quietly, "I think I have good reason to fear being made a French prisoner, but I hope I would not ask to have the lives of 15,000 men spent to save me from such a fate, with God only knows how many ordinary citizens killed also. If they establish their batteries of siege guns, and I do not see how you can prevent it forever, the city must be surrendered or reduced to rubble. Then we would be killed or taken in any case."
"We have a long road to travel before then," Calcrite said. "They will have slow going on their siege-works, with the ground frozen and a cold, unhealthy winter sitting outside our gates. You heard what he said about their supplies. They will not make any headway before March, I promise you, and a great deal can happen in so long a time."
His estimate seemed good at first. Seen through Lawrence's glass, the French soldiers picked and spaded the ground in an unenthusiastic manner, making little headway with their old and rust-bitten tools against the hard-packed earth, saturated through, so near to the river, and frozen hard already in the early winter. The wind brought drifts and flurries of snow off the sea, and frost climbed the window panes and the sides of his morning wash-basin each day before dawn. Lefebvre himself looked to be in no rush. They could see him, on occasion, wandering up and down the shallow beginnings of the trench, trailed by a handful of aides and his lips puckered in a whistle, not dissatisfied. Others, however, were not so content with the slow progress. Lawrence and Temeraire had been in the city scarcely a fortnight before Lien arrived. She came in the late afternoon out of the south, riderless, trailed only by a small escort of two middleweights and a courier, beating hard away from the leading edge of a winter gale that struck the city and the encampment scarcely half an hour after she had landed. She had been sighted by the city lookouts only, and for all the two long days of the storm, with snow obscuring all their sight of the French camp, Lawrence entertained some faint hope that a mistake had been made. Then he woke heart thundering the next day to a clear sky and the dying echoes of her terrible roar. He ran outside in nightshirt and dressing-gown, despite the cold and the ankle-deep snow not yet swept from the parapet. The sun was pale yellow and dazzling on the whitened fields and on Lien's marble-pale hide. She was standing at the edge of the French lines, inspecting the ground closely. As he and the appalled guards watched, she once again drew her breath deep, launched aloft, and directed her roar against the frozen earth. The snow erupted in blizzard clouds, dark clods of dirt flying, but the real damage was not to be recognized until later, when the French soldiers came warily back to work with their pickaxes and shovels. Her efforts had loosened the earth many feet down to below the frost line, so that their work now moved at a far more rapid pace. In a week the French works outstripped all their prior progress, the labour greatly encouraged by the presence of the White Dragon, who often came and paced back and forth along the lines, watchful for any sign of slackening, while the men dug frantically. Almost daily the French dragons now tried some sortie against the city's defences, mostly to keep the Prussians and their guns occupied while the infantry dug their trenches and set up their batteries. The artillery along the city walls kept the French dragons off, for the most part, but occasionally one of them would try and make a high aerial pass out of range to drop a load of bombs upon the city fortifications. Dropped from so great a height, these rarely hit their mark, but more often fell into the streets and houses, with much resulting misery. Already the townspeople, more Slavic than German and feeling no particular enthusiasm for the war, began to wish them all at Jericho. Calcrite daily served his men a ration of gunnery to return upon the French, though more for their morale than for what effect it would have upon the works, still too far away to reach. Once in a while a lucky shot would hit a gun, or carry away a few of the soldiers digging, and once to their delight struck a posted standard and sent it, with its crowning eagle, toppling over. That night Calcrite ordered an extra ration of spirits sent round to all, and gave the officers dinner. And when tide and wind permitted, the navy would creep in closer from their side and try a fusillade against the back of the French encampment. but Lefebvre was no fool, and none of his pickets were in range. Occasionally, Lawrence and Temeraire could see a small skirmish go forward over the harbour, a company of French dragons running a bombardment against the transports. But the quick barrage of canister and pepper shot from the warships as quickly drove them back in turn, neither side able to win a clear advantage against the other. The French might, with time enough, have built artillery emplacements enough to drive off the British ships, but they were not to be so distracted from their real goal, the capture of the city. Temeraire did his best to fend off the aerial attacks, but he was the only dragon in the city, barring a couple of tiny couriers and the hatchling, and his strength and speed had their limits. The French dragons spent their days flying idly around the city, over and over, taking it in shifts. Any flagging of Temeraire's attention, any slackening of the guard at the artillery, was an opportunity to pounce and do a little damage before dashing away again, and all the while the trenches slowly widened and grew, the soldiers as busy as an army of moles. Lien took no part in these skirmishes, save to pause and sit watching them, coiled and unblinking of eye. Her own labours were all for the siege works going steadily forward. With the divine wind she could certainly have perpetrated a great slaughter among the men on the ramparts, but she disdained to venture herself directly on the field.
"She is a great coward, if you ask me," Temeraire said, glad of an excuse to snort in her direction. "I would not let anyone make me hide away like that when my friends were fighting."
"I am not a coward,"
Iskierka threw in, briefly awake enough to notice what was going on around her. No one could have doubted her claim. Increasingly massive chains were required to restrain her from leaping into battle against full-grown dragons as yet 20 times her size, though daily that proportion was decreasing. Her growth was a fresh source of anxiety. Though prodigious, it was not yet sufficient to enable her either to fight or to fly effectively, but would soon make her a serious burden upon Temeraire should they attempt to make their escape. Now she rattled her latest chain furiously.
"I want to fight too! Let me loose!"
"You can only fight once you are bigger, like she is," Temeraire said hurriedly. "Eat your sheep."
"I am bigger! Much!" she said resentfully,
but having dismantled the sheep she fell shortly fast asleep again, and was at least temporarily silenced. Lawrence drew no such sanguine conclusions. He knew Lien was lacking neither in physical courage nor in skill, from the example of her duel with Temeraire in the Forbidden City. Perhaps she might yet be governed, to some extent, by the Chinese prescription against celestials engaging in combat, but Lawrence suspected that in her refusal to engage directly they rather saw the cunning restraint appropriate to a commander. The position of the French troops was thoroughly secure, and she was too valuable to risk for only insignificant gain. The daily exhibition of her natural authority over the other dragons, and her intuitive understanding of how best they could be put to use, soon confirmed Lawrence in his sense of the very material advantage to the French of her taking on what seemed so curious a role. Under her direction, the dragons forwent formation drill in favour of light skirmishing manoeuvres. When not so engaged, they lent themselves to the digging, further speeding the progress of the trenches. Certainly the soldiers were uneasy at sharing such close quarters with dragons, but Lefebvre managed them with displays of his own unconcern, walking among the labouring dragons and slapping them on their flanks, joking loudly with their crews, though Lien gave him a very astonished look on the one occasion when he used her so, as a stately duchess might to a farmer pinching her on the cheek. The French had the advantage of superior morale, after all their lightning victories, and the excellent motive of getting inside the city walls before the worst of the winter struck.
"But the essential point is, it is not only the Chinese who grow up among them, who can grow accustomed. The French have gotten used to it," Lawrence said to Granby, amid hasty bites of his bread and butter. Temeraire had come down to the courtyard for a brief rest after another early morning skirmish.
"Yes, and these good Prussian fellows also, who have Temeraire and Iskierka crammed in amongst them," Granby said, patting her side, which rose and fell like a bellows beside him.
She opened an eye without waking and made a pleased, drowsy murmur at him, accompanied with a few jets of steam from her spines, before closing it again.
"Why shouldn't they?" Temeraire said,
crunching several leg bones in his teeth like walnut shells.
"They must recognize us by now, unless they are very stupid, and know that we are not going to hurt them, except Iskierka might. By mistake," he added, a little doubtfully.
She had developed the inconvenient habit of occasionally scorching her meat before she ate it, without much attention to who, if anyone, might be in her general vicinity at the time. Kalkreuth no longer spoke of what might happen, or of long waits. His men were drilling daily to make ready for an attack on the advancing French.
"Once they are in range of our guns, we will sortie against them at night," he said grimly. "Then, if we accomplish nothing more, we can at least make some distraction that may give you a chance at escaping."
"Thank you, sir. I am deeply obliged to you," Lawrence said.
Such a desperate attempt, with all the attendant risk of injury or death, nevertheless recommended itself greatly when laid against the choice to quietly hand himself and Temeraire over. Lawrence did not doubt for an instant that Lien's arrival was owed to their presence. The French might be willing to take their time, more concerned with the capture of the citadel. She had other motives. Whatever Napoleon's plans and hers for the discomfiture of Britain, to witness them as helpless prisoners, under a sure sentence of death for Temeraire, was as terrible a fate as Lawrence could conceive, and any end preferable to falling into her power. But he added,
"I hope, sir, that you do not risk more than you ought, helping us so. They may resent it sufficiently to withdraw the offer of honourable surrender, should their victory seem, as I fear it now must, a question merely of time."
Kalkreuth shook his head, not in denial, a refusal.
"And so, if we took Lefebvre's offer, even if he let us go, what then? All the men disarmed and dismissed, my officers bound by parole not to lift a hand for a year. What good will it do us to be released honourably rather than to make unconditional surrender? Either way, the corps will be utterly broken up, just like all the rest. They have undone all the Prussian army. Every battalion dissolved, all the officers swept into the bag. There will be nothing even left to rebuild around."
He looked up from his maps and despondency and gave Lawrence a twisted smile.
"So, you see, it is not so great a thing that I should offer to hold fast for your sake. We are already looking total destruction in the face."
They began their preparations. None of them spoke of the batteries of artillery which would be directed upon them, or the 30 dragons and more who would try and bar their way. There was, after all, nothing to be done about them. The date of the sortie was fixed for 2 days hence, on the first night of the new moon, when the gloom should hide them from all but the fleur de nuit. Pratt was hammering silver platters into armour plates. Calloway was packing flash powder into bombs. Temeraire, to avoid giving any hint of their intentions, was hovering over the city, as was his usual wont, and in one stroke all their planning and work was overthrown. He said abruptly,
"Lawrence, there are some more dragons coming,"
and pointed out over the ocean. Lawrence opened up his glass, and, squinting against the glare of the sun, could just make out the approaching forces, a shifting group of perhaps as many as 20 dragons coming in fast and low over the water. There was nothing more to be said. He took Temeraire down to the courtyard to alert the garrison to the oncoming attack and to take shelter behind the fortress guns. Granby was standing anxiously by the sleeping Ischierke in the courtyard, having overheard Lawrence's shout.
"Well, that has torn it,"
he said, climbing up to the city walls with Lawrence and borrowing his glass for a look.
"Not a prayer of getting past 2 dozen more of—"
He stopped. The handful of French dragons in the air were hurriedly taking up defensive positions against the newcomers. Temeraire rose up on his hind legs and propped himself against the city wall for a better view, much to the dismay of the soldiers stationed on the ramparts, who dived out of the way of his great talons.
"Lawrence, they are fighting," he said in great excitement. "Is it our friends? Is it Maximus and Lily?"
"Lord, what timing!"
Granby said joyfully.
"Surely it cannot be," Lawrence said.
But he felt a sudden wild hope blazing in his chest, remembering the 20 promised British dragons. Though how they should have come now, and here to Danzig, of all places. But they had come in from the sea, and they were fighting the French dragons. No formations at all, only a kind of general skirmishing, but they had certainly engaged. Taken off their guard and surprised, the small guard of French dragons fell back in disarray, little by little, towards the walls, and before the rest of their force could come to their aid, the newcomers had broken through their line. Hurtling forward, they set up a loud and gleeful yowling as they came tumbling pell-mell into the great courtyard of the fortress, a riot of wings and bright colours, and a preening, smug Arcady landed just before Temeraire and threw his head back full of swagger. Temeraire exclaimed,
"But whatever are you doing here?" before repeating the question to him in the Durzag tongue. Arkady immediately burst into a long and rambling explanation, interrupted at frequent junctures by the other ferals, all of whom clearly wished to add their own mite to the account. The cacophony was incredible, and the dragons added to it by getting into little squabbles amongst themselves, roaring and hissing and trading knocks, so that even the aviators were quite bewildered with the noise, and the poor Prussian soldiers, who had only just begun to be used to have the well-behaved Temeraire and the sleeping Iskierke in their midst, began to look positively wild around the eyes.
"I hope we are not unwelcome,"
the quieter voice drew Lawrence around, away from the confusion, and he found Tharkay standing before him, thoroughly wind-blown and disarrayed, but with his mild, sardonic look unchanged, as though he regularly made such an entrance.
"Tharkay? Most certainly you are welcome. Are you responsible for this?"
Lawrence demanded.
"I am. But I assure you I have been thoroughly punished for my sins," Tharkay said dryly, shaking Lawrence's hand and Granby's. "I thought myself remarkably clever for the notion, until I found myself crossing two continents with them. After the journey we have had, I am inclined to think it an act of grace that we have arrived."
"I can well imagine," Lawrence said. "Is this why you left? You said nothing of it."
"Nothing is what I thought most likely would come of it," Tharkay said with a shrug. "But as the Prussians were demanding 20 British dragons, I thought I might as well try and fetch these to suit them."
"And they came?" Granby said, staring at the ferals. "I never heard of such a thing. Grown ferals agreeing to go into harness? How did you persuade them?"
"Vanity and greed," Tharkay said. "Arkady, I fancy, was not unhappy to engage himself to rescue Temeraire, when I had put it to him in those terms. As for the rest, they found the Sultan's fat kine much more to their liking than the lean goats and pigs which are all the fare they can get in the mountains. I promised that in your service they should receive 1 cow a day apiece. I hope I have not committed you too far."
"For 20 dragons? You might have promised each and every one of them a herd of cows," Lawrence said. "But how have you come to find us here? It seems to me we've been wandering halfway across creation."
"It seemed so to me also," Tharkay said, "and if I have not lost my sense of hearing in the process, it is no fault of my company. We lost your trail around Jena. After a couple of weeks terrorizing the countryside, I found a banker in Berlin who had seen you. He said if you had not been captured yet, you would likely be here or at Königsberg with the remains of the army. And here you behold us." He waved a hand over the assembled motley of dragon kind, now jostling one another for the best positions in the courtyard. Iskierke, who had so far miraculously slept through all the bustle, had the comfortable, warm place up against the wall of the barracks kitchens. One of Arkady's lieutenants was bending down to nudge her away.
"Oh, no!"
Granby said in alarm, and dashed for the stairs down to the courtyard. Quite unnecessarily, for Iskierke woke just long enough to hiss out a warning lick of flame across the big grey dragon's nose, which sent him hopping back with a bellow of surprise. The rest promptly gave her a wide, respectful berth, little as she was, and gradually arranged themselves in other, more convenient places, such as upon the roofs, the courtyards, and the open terraces of the city, much to the loud, shrieking dismay of the inhabitants.
20 of them," Kalkreuth said, staring at little Gerny, who was sleeping peacefully on his balcony.
Her long, narrow tail was poking in through the doors and lying across the floor of the room, occasionally twitching and thumping against the floor.
"And they will obey?"
"Well, they will mind Temeraire, more or less, and their own leader," Lawrence said doubtfully. "More than that I will not venture to guarantee. In any case, they can only understand their own tongue or a smattering of some Turkish dialect."
Kalkreuth was silent, toying with a letter opener upon his desk, twisting the point into the polished surface of the wood, heedless of damage.
"No,"
he said finally, mostly to himself,
"it would only stave off the inevitable."
Lawrence nodded quietly. He himself had spent the last few hours contemplating ways and means of assault with their new aerial strength, some kind of attack which might drive the French away from the city. But they were still outnumbered in the air 3 dragons to 2, and the ferals could not be counted on to carry out any sort of strategic manoeuvre. As individual skirmishers they would do, as disciplined soldiers they were a disaster ready to occur. Kalkreuth added,
But I hope there will be enough, Captain, to see you and your men safely away. For that alone I am grateful to them. You have done all you could for us. Go and Godspeed.
Sir, I only regret we cannot do more, and I thank you, Lawrence said. He left Calcroyd still standing beside his desk, head bowed, and went back down to the courtyard.
"Let us get the armour on him, Mr. Fellows," Lawrence said quietly to the ground crew master, and nodded to Lieutenant Ferris. "We will leave as soon as it is dark."
The crew set about their work silently. They were none of them pleased to be leaving under such circumstances. It was impossible not to look at the 20 dragons disposed about the fortress as a force worth putting to real use in its defence, and the desperate escape they had planned to risk alone felt now selfish, when they meant to take all those dragons with them.
"Lawrence," Temeraire said abruptly, "wait! Why must we leave them like this?"
"I am sorry to do it also, my dear," Lawrence said heavily, "but the position is untenable. The fortress must fall eventually, no matter what we do. It will do them no good in the end for us to stay and be captured with them."
"That is not what I mean," Temeraire said. "There are a great many of us now. Why do we not take the soldiers away with us?"
"Can it be done?" Calcroyd asked, and they worked out the figures of the desperate scheme with feverish speed. There were just enough transports in the harbour to squeeze the men aboard, Lawrence judged, though they should have to be crammed into every nook from the hold to the manger.
"We will give those jack-tars a proper start dropping onto them out of nowhere," Granby said dubiously. "I hope they may not shoot us out of the air."
"So long as they do not lose their heads, they must realize that an attack would never come so low," Lawrence said. "And I will take Temeraire to the ships first and give them a little warning. He at least can hover overhead and let the passengers down by ropes. The others will have to land on deck. Thankfully, they are none of them so very large." Every silk curtain and linen sheet in the elegant patrician homes was being sacrificed to the cause, much against their owners' wishes, and every seamstress of the city had been pressed into service, thrust into the vast ballroom of the general's residence to sew the carrying harnesses under the improvisational direction of Fellows.
"Sirs, begging your pardon, I won't stand on oath they'll any of them hold," he said. "How these things are rigged in China, ordinary, I'm sure I don't know. And as for what we're doing, it'll be the queerest stuff dragon ever wore, or man ever rode on. I can't say plainer than that."
"Do what you can," General Calcroy said crisply, "and any man who prefers may stay and be made prisoner."
"We cannot take the horses, or the guns, of course," Lawrence said.
"Save the men. Horses and guns can be replaced," Calcroy said. "How many trips will we need?"
"I am sure I could take at least 300 men if I were not wearing armour," Temeraire said. They were carrying on their discussion in the courtyard, where he could offer his opinions. "The little ones cannot take so many, though."
The first carrying harness was brought down to try. Arcady edged back from it a little uneasily until Temeraire made some pointed remarks and turned to adjust a strap of his own harness, at which the feral leader immediately presented himself, chest outthrust, and made no further difficulties. Aside from turning himself round several times in an effort to see what was being done, and thus causing a few of the harness men to fall off. Once rigged out, Arcady promptly began prancing before his comrades. He looked uncommonly silly, as the harness was partly fashioned out of patterned silks that had likely come from a lady's boudoir. But he plainly found himself splendid, and the rest of the ferals murmured enviously. There was rather more difficulty getting men to volunteer to board him, until Calcroyd roundly cursed them all for cowards and climbed on himself. His aides promptly followed him up in a rush, even arguing a little over who should go up first, and with this example before them the reluctant men were so shamed they too began clamouring to board, to which Tharke, observing the whole, remarked a little dryly that men and dragons were not so very different in some respects.